Instructional Designers in Offices Drinking Coffee is brought to you by Domino, makers of Domino One, the all-in-one cloud-based e-learning authoring tool for teams. You can learn more at domino.com. That's domino.com. Now, here's this week's episode.
I was a little late on the button, but here we are! Woohoo! It's Wednesday morning, everybody. Look at all the weather reports coming in.
Full participation.
That was outstanding.
We've had one other guest join us in costume with a big disco fro one other time. And so, like that's amazing. You just have, you know, your Sherlock Holmes gear just lying around, eh? Nice.
No, I mean, if I turn around, I go in five different directions here. You know, SAG-AFTRA taught me a lot.
We're going to have to, for those of you listening to this podcast afterwards, you'll have to check out the YouTube to get the,
just to check out the opening moments when this week's special guest, Sherlock Hodel, joins us.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's just the way it is.
Love it.
Yeah. Call me Shirley. Don't call me Shirley.
Yeah, but don't call me Shirley.
Let's do airplane movie jokes.
Chuck, you jest. I mean, wait, no.
What's the vector, Victor? We could do this all day.
Call me late for dinner. Anyway.
Yeah.
My gosh, folks. Sorry about the identity confusion here. We thought we had Chuck Hodel joining us this morning, and then suddenly Sherlock Holmes appeared, pipe and all.
Yeah,
and
ready to go.
And now Chuck's back, so I don't know where Sherlock went. Maybe he'll join us later.
If necessary. Yeah,
it's all elementary, my dear idiotics. Anyway.
Thank you, Watson.
That's right. Gang, oh. Chuck Hodel is joining us. Chuck, you haven't been with us yet on any of our episodes, so tell our gang here who's joining us in today's session. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, all you need to know is I'm an instructional designer. And that's what I'm most proud of. That's what I do for a living. I like to teach. I like to write. Faculty at Northeastern right now, and also University of Maryland School of Pharmacy in their palliative care master's and PhD programs. So, and you wouldn't think that instructional design would be part of that, but it's an integral part of that program. And we're going to talk, I'm sure, this whole notion of what instructional design is now, riding this new wave, mm-hmm. and watching the incredible things that are happening in our field. So if you remember anything about me, just remember I love instructional design and all the people that are in it.
I don't think a lot of people even know that there is an instructional design wave. And so it's nice to see somebody who's been around for a while, right? Who you've ridden the ups and downs of the industry, seen it when nobody cared. And, you know, Chris had a great point. Let's start there. Where was that specific point you wanted to start, Chris? Because I thought that was a good idea.
Just the idea of this being, there being a wave right now opportunity in instructional design and even just a sort of broader awareness. I know for 20 years now, even, you know, my kids and even my wife will say, you know, oh, or get asked, you know, what does your dad do? You know,
what do you do?
Dad, what do you do? I'm an instructional designer. Oh, what does that mean? You know, it's not a common trade that, you know, in the cultural, you know, people don't have a picture of that. And yet there's been a real surge, in the last few years in terms of its, you know, its awareness. And you were even talking in the green room about, you know, sort of the wave of opportunities that you've been seeing. So let's run through some of what you're seeing on that front, just to give people a sense of how things are a little different right now.
Well, I think what's changed is an identity. We now have visibility. We now have a name that people recognize. And nothing we've done has changed over the last 30 years. What's changed is people have self-identified as instructional designers. and organizations have realized that they are using instructional designers, no matter what they call them. And if you look down through the titles that could be even reasonably associated with being an instructional designer, there's literally hundreds of them. I think in the last book that I have with ATD, I've listed over 100 of them. And what's gradually happened over time is people realize that if you don't have a systems approach to what you do with education and training, that you might be throwing your money out the window. You know, the decision tree of, do I really have an issue I can address? What's the most realistic way to address that? Do I really know my population? Do I really have any idea what I want them to do when they leave? And importantly to me is, will they be able to use this when they get back to where they work? Or am I just spinning the wheels and doing happy time? And over the years, people have learned that, why should we waste our money with just going out and doing a happy day? Why don't we actually do training and education? Why don't we bring people into the field that are professionals with those? They have their master's degrees or certifications or enough years experience that they can say, here's how you do this, and I can show you how to do this. So Bureau of Labor Statistics says we are one of the top fields through 2030. So 2020 to 2030, they're showing between 9 and 10% growth in our field, which is not common across most fields. So if you look at the top 10 jobs the next 10 years, a lot of them say engineering behind them in some form, except one. So I now call us instructional engineers. So maybe we can get in that top 10. But so BLS says, yeah, we're going places. If you look, I can only speak for the DMV, which is around DC, but there are thousands of jobs that are going unfilled. And it's just an amazing thing. So now Denver Broncos hired an instructional designer. And the headline in Sports Illustrated is, instructional designer hired by Denver Broncos. And I'm thinking, you know, did I fall asleep for 15 years or what happened here? But now we're mainstream. So
I can't believe I didn't even see that.
Oh, no, it's incredible. In fact, one of the people that we have on our podcast, Holly, actually reached out to Denver Broncos, tried to get the individual into an interview to talk about instructional design with the National Football League, which, if you think about it, you know, they don't line up, but they do. And that's the point of this. Instructional designers are systems people. We're systems analysts. We know how to put these discrete parts together and make them work. And that's not only true in education and training, it's true generally in the world. If you know what your inputs and outputs are, and you spin in a little chaos theory and everything else that is part of our world, then you are a valuable asset. You are somebody that's going to help an organization, whether that's a nonprofit, whether that's a for-profit, whether that's within a government or a military or any other kind of field. You know, you've got a role to play and a big role to play. And I am so excited about instructional design.
Mm-hmm. And it's really cool. I mean, we're a line of work that so many people come in, you know, sideways into, right?
Yeah, always.
I mean, the vast majority of us have come from something else that led us into doing something training related, and then we kind of found that our passion in this space, and then many of us go off and find, you know, formal instruction then to beef up, so we're not just doing what the person before us left us with, as a model or a template. But we're definitely still very much that's how many people get into this space. I've often sort of joked that on career day in high school, there isn't a table for instructional design, you know, where you can go and, you know, find that out as a career.
It's usually the school counselor there if you're interested. Yeah. Let me lead you into a better life. It's not for you.
They send you to the nurse. With this one.
Yeah. Get a coffee, right? Everything we do in instructional design is built around caffeine. So,
hey, you know, all right. Well,
I'll start off early.
I'll drink to that. Hey, it looks like we've had a lot of people jump in and answer our poll. Not everybody has jumped into the poll yet. Maybe they can't find the little poll button to the left of the chat at the bottom of the screen. And we got it's split about 50-50, really. But I got 12 votes. 42% say, yes, I am strictly an ID. And I call myself that. And we just got some motion there. Now as we've moved up to 51% of people say no, I use a different title, but I do ID work. So votes. So yeah, we got a good mix here, and I think this is pretty indicative of what you're talking about, really. because
it's a self-identity thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, two of my sons have graduate credentials in instructional design, and we have a vow that we will not say anything about our work when the family's together because the rest of the family has no concept of what we do. And that's just generally true. We don't self-identify. And if we do self-identify, we're kind of quiet around it. And one thing that I've found is most instructional designers are introverts. We're very happy to be in the hallway and not out front the dais. And that's where I've always been most comfortable. I'd rather be behind the scenes getting things done than even doing things like this, because I'm such an introvert. Mm. And I think a lot of people, it's difficult for them to self-identify as instructional designers because they've really never had it defined for them in the context of what they do. And I think when we do that, then what we find is most teachers, most trainers, and certainly the millions of subject matter experts out there supplying information, being part of our teams, they're all instructional designers. If you've ever designed a course on a napkin, you're an instructional designer. If you ever had to get up and do 15 minutes at your weekly staff meeting, you're an instructional designer. And the more people self-identify and the more people realize that there are tools out there to make this work better and your product better, then I think you start to look at that. And some great comments in here. Some mm-hmm. of my students are in there. Gosh. and somebody from my home state of Ohio, OH10. I'm from Dayton. So, Kimberly, I don't know where you're from. You know, I want to put in there what town you hail from. But, no, I'm born and raised in Dayton. So.
Well, and there was a Cincinnati and Cleveland conversation going on even before we started.
Oh, that's perfect. Okay. So, OH10 is well represented.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Ohio represent. Yeah.
I don't have my Hello Cleveland soundbite queued up. Dang it. Get that. Yeah,
a few other things. Jan mentioning, you know, exactly, sideways entry. I have a marketing degree and stumbled into this. Yeah. Kim mentioning I came in backwards and found I love it. And Tanya's saying, we're like platypus. Tanya, I want you to elaborate. I would like you to elaborate a little bit more on that. That seems like you can explore that a bit more. Kimberly is mentioning I'm a banker. Kimberly is mentioning banker who found instructional design and introvert. And lots of folks who do are self-identifying as introverts.
Yeah. I used to do research on this with my populations in grad school. And I came up with an average of 70% introverts. And that's not reflective of the population in general. And I think what we find is people that like to just put their head down and do the work are more likely to be instructional designers, because a lot of us don't teach. And I would say 99% of the things I design, I would never teach. I mean, it's not what I do. It's not what I'm hired to do. It's not what I'm there to do. And that really makes a big difference. But in terms of this lateral progression, I think it would amaze people to know how many people from other fields, and I would say almost everybody I know came from somewhere else.
Right.
You're not starting out. I know of one person that went through and in their early 20s decided they wanted to be an instructional designer. Mm-hmm. And that's only because there was a parental influence there from a family of instructional designers. But some of the populations I teach, like I had a student who was a professor at a medical college, a very well-known medical college. So a teaching university in hospital teaching doctors, who came in, took some courses, fell in love with instructional design, quit the faculty at a medical school. Now think about this. And is now full-time designing in different medical related content areas. And that's not unusual. So I see physicians, I see attorneys. I've had a lot of attorneys went lateral. They're putting together great stuff to help people with the law, you know, whether that's, you know, however you want to define that. So I think the recognition of the fact that we are an amalgamate of everything else out in the world. You know, we are lawyers, we are doctors. You know, I was a police officer. I was lots of things before I ever thought about even going to college. And that's okay. If you're out there on the fence, you say, well, I don't know anything about instructional design. Well, hello, I knew nothing about instructional design. I couldn't spell ISD. And, you know, I went on to have an average career at it. So I think you can too. But I think that's the message that we need to be spreading to people that are listening, watching, that we talk to, that just show a casual interest in doing this and tremendous work, is you can do this. You're going to join people that have gone the same path that you have. Yellow brick road, pull back the curtain. It's people like you're seeing on your screen right now, people in the chat room. And that's the beauty of this. It is us. It is who we are. And we are all of these things. And all of these things make us better designers, because we now have the reality of these kind of work situations and that kind of content area. And I've worked with complete jerks and I've worked with complete saints. And I can take all of that and put it into a committee of subject matter experts I work with, or dealing with those above me trying to make cases for things that I need to do. And you know, if you like a challenge and you like detail and you like doing great work and changing people's lives, instructional design is for you.
Mm-hmm. What has changed down, like, since, you know, I let me be more specific. How has technology, as you've seen it throughout your career coming through, how has that changed it? Like, how many people do you think need to be technology literate to, like, build e-learning or build, you know, digital content for folks? Do instructional designers really need to, or is there still a place for the purest instructional designer that doesn't do tech? Because I get that asked of me a lot in different forums, and you know, I have my own way of answering it, but I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Well, my stock answer is that nothing has changed in instructional design since about 1944, when Robert Gagné and Merrill and all the rest of them brought the social sciences to what we do and formalized it and recognized it was a science. What changes is specific elements of the design process. So whether I'm designing for e-learning or I'm designing for classroom learning, I'm still going through the same process. I'm plugging in different modules here and there. I may bring in a programmer. I may bring in a graphic artist. I may shoot video. I may do this or that. But in the end, I'm still doing what I do as an instructional designer. So if you look at technology, I had the first online learning course in a DC area in 1989. And this was done by email.
Wow. Oh,
and I had to borrow. I had
correspondence training. Isn't that what they called it back then?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, courses.
This goes back to 1847 in the UK, where they had one on, you know, some skill that I don't remember, but you got it in the mail. So I did this with email just to prove a point that you could distribute learning using technology. And okay, and then we went to multimedia, which everybody had to have something on a DVD, and we had the products that came out. And so I remember when I first got into this and I was in grad school, we had to program. We programmed what we had for e-learning. We didn't use a software package. We sat there and wrote code. And so now we've evolved from that, where a designer had to be, you know, whatever they had to be to do that, to now we can hire subject matter experts or use subject matter experts to plug in where we need them. So get the best of the best to do the things you need to be done. But I will argue and continue to argue instructional design hasn't changed at all. The only thing that's changed is implementation. And those variables still exist, and we're 35-40% e-learning now, but higher education is still asleep at the switch. We've got organizations that don't want to do this for whatever reason. That's fine, but you've got to look at what that costs you in terms of what you could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the value, for sure. Mm-hmm.
So Tanya followed up in the chat about the platypus comment. And what she says is, we are an odd mix. Okay, platypus, got it, odd mix. We are an odd mix that makes us amazing at many things, but people can't figure us out and don't understand how our different skills fit together.
Yeah,
yeah, that kind of feels sort of like when you know, going back to the start of our conversation. So what do you do? Well, I'm an instructional designer. Which means that there is no short version when we have to describe, you know, what we do.
I don't think there is. And I'm not going to apologize for that, because one of the things I found, all of us working with clients, a lot of times we have to go into board meetings and we have to make the case for using instructional design. And I have been in some of the most awful conversations with boards over what a waste of time it is to pay somebody to put together a course when I've got instructors in the classroom that teach every day. So why do we need this stuff? And, you know, Yeah, it's just all these arguments. And anymore, I don't even have a discussion with them. So, you know, this is what I do. I make your stuff better. and I will save you money, and I will do all these things that are important for you. And you just have to trust me. When you go into a car dealership, do you sit there with a mechanic and try to second guess what they're doing when your engine's on the floor? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, how many parallels of wisdom can we put into this? So anymore, except when I have to, I just go on my credibility and my experience and my product and say, you have to trust me with this. This is what I do. Just tell me what you want. Leave me alone, and I'll give you what you want in the end. But but that's my experience. I just, the more I get into trying to explain what I do, the less I seem to make any headway with a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah. And partly that's the fact that so many, every one of us, no matter whether we know this notion of instructional design or not or whatever, we've all experienced something, you know, our entire lives, we've got a model in our mind of something called teaching or you know, training or whatever. It's that somebody standing in front of the classroom telling us things, or, you know, that thing that we all experienced in school and then on into, you know, post-school, et cetera. So everybody already thinks they know, everybody outside of our realm already thinks they know what we do. So that complicates our self-image, you know, that people have certain presumptions about, oh, you're going to stand in front of the room and tell us these things or whatever, you know.
Well, the great teacher theory died many years ago. Mm-hmm. And what anybody who's worked in higher education had to migrate courses from classroom to online, especially in the last 2 years. What you quickly realize that letting go of that space as a professor or a teacher is tough to do. And I've always recognized that, tried to work around that. But at the same time, you make the courses better. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to give up that space sometimes. But then you have that resistance to, well, how do you know what you're doing? I got a PhD or an ED, or I got a this or a that. You're going to tell me how to teach? And I said, yeah. Sadly, I'm going to. Actually, because this is what, this is what I do for a living. I'm not going to tell you what to teach, but I'm going to tell you what an efficient training or learning package looks like. And I'm going to help you with objectives, which nobody in higher education wants to write objectives. 4-part behavioral objectives, you might as well just ask them to drink poison. Because, you know, but the regional accrediting bodies are now saying you have to have real objectives. You have to have real evaluation for courses. You can't just say, well, you did great. Thank you. See you next term. You know, you have to show where there's mastery that matches your objectives, which we call a performance agreement. And so the professionalization of this has kind of worked in a way that creates some barriers for this. And I think those are honest barriers. But nobody likes to give up that space. Nobody wants to get off of the stage sometimes. And that's really tough to do.
Yeah, it's the story of our lives, right? I mean, it's trying to get people to understand it and then allow us the time and the opportunity to do the work that we do. And then at the end of it, all they see is that a course was created or an online course was created. I think that's part of the battle that we've been fighting, is that they don't see all the work. They just see an end result that kind of looks similar, that might be a little bit different visually. The course might still, maybe a piece of it has somebody standing in front of the classroom and talking, and most of them aren't engaged in the content, and they don't see the details of how things are presented differently, how this facilitator has changed, or how the content has been organized a little differently, or how the objectives are written. They don't read it. They just see this final product as being similar to what they had before, or what they had in their mind. And so they scratch their head and they're like, I don't understand. Like, what did you do? What did you add to the puzzle? Yeah. So, you know, I think that's partly our fault, right? Like not being good about showing the benefits that we add.
One of the things that I say, and I practice, it's in my book on subject matter experts, is if you don't make subject matter experts part of the team and equal partners, so this is the same for instructors that you're migrating the courses or training folks in the classroom and an apprenticeship or anywhere else that you're helping them with their programs. If you don't make them equal partners in the project and on the team, then you've lost it. Second thing you need to do is you need to sit down, and I even have a half-day course in the book for instructional designers to give to subject matter experts. Okay, here are the basics of what we do as instructional design. This is what we are responsible for. This is what you should be responsible for. And as long as everybody understands what they're doing, you know, we can work out the details and the rest of it. And I found that to be true with instructors too. When you have very smart people in academia or having their courses migrated against their will, you need to recognize that, make them partners. Say, we're doing this together. This is not Chuck or the team doing this. This is you and I and everybody involved making your product something we can use online. It's not about anything else. And I think the more that you invite them in, the more you make them real partners, the more you tell them and explain to them what it is you do for a living and where you're going to have to work hard and make decisions and where they're going to have to work hard and provide stuff. Once you work out all that logistical stuff and team stuff and whatever you want to call it, then you can concentrate on the product. And if you have issues, I'd rather have them in that first couple meetings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes I'll even say, okay, I know you're not happy. I'm going to give you 15 minutes to call me anything you want to. I've done this a lot. It's like, okay, I know you're mad. I have no responsibility for that. I'm just here. But if you want to say anything you want to say, it's off the record for 15 minutes and I will not take notes and I will not remember it at minute 16, but get it off your chest because we got work to do. Yeah. And sometimes they'll say a few things and then they'll start laughing or they'll smile or, you know, and you move on and you have a great program. But I think the fact that you need to recognize their space and what they're seeing and what they're feeling, you know, that's really important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do have a book on how to work with SMEs, I believe. I know you're a humble man and you don't want to, you know, show all the books you've written and whatnot, but there is one out there for you folks. If you hit up ATD, you can find that out there to get all these great nuggets about subject matter experts and whatnot. It is a question that comes up all the time and people do have that difficulty. I mean, that's one thing about our job that hasn't changed, right? Dealing with subject matter experts. And I know we're talking about the wave of instructional design, but I think that's really part of it, right? It's part of the work. That's part of why so many people love what they do at instructional design, I think. It's that we get to learn something new every day also, because unless, in some situations, maybe not, but typically as an instructional designer, you're given a new topic to, or a new course, or a new instructor, teacher, whatever, that you're needing to help build something. And so, as you're going through this process, you're learning the content as well, but you have to kind of be able to know how to pull it out of people that are keeping it locked in their head for whatever reason.
Get the pliers out. Yeah, get the cerebral pliers.
Yeah.
But you know, you bring up a great point because, number one, I think our work with subject matter experts is going to be the next big turn for instructional designers. I think recognition, learning to work with them, bringing them into our field, and doing all these things, I think that's going to – not technology. I think it's subject matter experts. I think that's the future. The next big turn is bringing them into the fold so that we're now seamless. And if you look at what large organizations are doing, I mean, I used to have projects where I would have 60 or 70 subject matter experts in one room. We used to have to get an auditorium and a building. And I would have 15 or 20 instructional designers. I'd have two or three with each of these groups of 5 to 7 subject matter experts. And this is all going at once. I mean, it's just the buzz and the rum and all the things that go on with this. And now I see it more and more. I see really intelligent instructional design leadership finding out that they can work with these folks and do these other things. And technology is important, but technology is going to be different tomorrow than it is today. Now, what's not going to change is the resources and the real gems that we have in these people and in our fellow designers to be able to do these things.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of questions in the chat. Sean is asking, I hail from a 20 plus year history in corporate America with a number of titles, none of them training related, who always had a finger in instructional design and instruction. I was hired as an EA in administration and higher ed, where I was able to pursue my passion and a master's in ID and just got my CPTM. I have an online portfolio and I've been applying for a vast number of jobs, but not much action. So any suggestions for landing an interview?
Well, if you go to the YouTube channel Denise Cardona and I've got 5 videos on there on doing ISD interviews. Oh, cool. And It's the first interview. It's what to say to get the second interview. It's how to follow up. And I think essentially, since most of them are migrating from something to instructional design, what I found most useful is going with a great attitude about learning and saying, I have all of this experience in these areas. What I'm learning now is how to tie that into instructional design. I'm willing to get whatever certification I need to get to do this. I'm willing to work within the organization to find the best fit for this function, but I'm willing to grow and to learn. And I've found from the feedback I'm getting from people that are interviewing now that most organizations are not filling jobs that they want to fill because they're keeping their credentialing level too high. Mm-hmm. If you're expecting a master's in instructional design or a PhD in something, why don't you look at these really bright people that are willing to go get that credential, whether it's from ATD or whether it's an academic credential or whatever, that they're willing to put some time and effort into learning more about the field. You're going to find that those kind of folks are going to do well in interviews if they get into the right group, if you get into to an organization that really wants to do this. If you're stuck in the HR barrel and you never really get to talk to the people that are doing the work or the managing the work, then that's kind of a different scenario. But I've found that the people that go in that are open to learning, that are open to finding out about an organization and finding the best fit, really do pretty well with this. There is the overqualification issue sometimes, but I've even seen that kind of go away with this.
Very cool. Next question, and this one draws a little bit more down in specifics about instructional design. What differences do you see between using a template approach to course design versus the value of standards like quality matters, and quality matters being capitalized there? That's from Richard.
Yeah. So I think this goes back to the basics of like which model to use, right? So if you're in an organization that produces essentially the same kind of course every time with different content, but they're all 60 minutes and they're all this format, and you know, we got the style sheet with the right colors and the logos and everything, you got a different design environment than somebody works freelance. It goes out and every single one of the things they do is different. So just like people argue about Addy or Sam, which is an argument that'll never be answered. Both of those are models. Those are not templates or workflow models, right? So what you're going to find is whatever resonates best with you. And if you find anything resonates best with you, then that's what you should do. But each design is different. Every design scenario is different. There are different variables. There are different people. And unless you're lucky enough to work in an environment where you are able to timestamp stuff through, and here's the template, and here's the style sheet, and this course this week is on this, good for you. I mean, go do it. But most of us are going to have to find resonance with what we know, with the models, analysis, design, development, implementation, evaluation. If you want to use Addy, if you want to use SAM, if you want to use rapid prototyping, KEMP, any of those models, don't use them as a workflow. Use them as a background for things you need to think about, you need to do, and then come up with what resonates best with what you've got in terms of content populations and end game.
Yeah. My first work in this space, I was presented with a model of an e-learning course structure, which was, 1 hour contained 20 learning objects. It had to have a mix of media, 20% audio, 20% text, 20% video. And there were, rationalizations behind around all of these sorts of, the structure, et cetera. But ultimately, you end up going, well, yeah, okay. We promised a 1 hour course, but it doesn't take 1 hour. There's only a half hour needed to get
hello.
Through this. We have this thing, but okay, not everything fits in the. And that was sort of the organizational structure in my early time.
Because they were very comfortable with having that template, because then they didn't have to think about it.
Yeah,
but once you blew it up, I hope you were able to show them that one size does not fit all when it comes to learning.
Yeah, yeah.
And your chunks are either too small or too small, and your populations may not be unique cost continuum from novice to expert. I mean, here's what's so incredible about instructional design is it's so incredibly intricate. You can't just look at one thing and say, oh, I got 60 minutes. Well, good for you. So I had a client once who demanded that everything be like that, be in his boxes. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what if you don't have enough content for 60 minutes? And they kind of looked at me. So the next meeting, I brought a guitar. And I said, here's what we're going to do to fill the time after we're done teaching with your 60 minutes. And I took the guitar out and I started singing. And I said, is that the approach you want to instructional design? That we're going to fill the dead time with entertainment? You know, I have friends in the industry. You know, Weird Al could do 5 minutes. You know, you tell me where you want to go with this. If you want a professional design, let's find the best fit for what we got. But don't expect professionals to fall into something like this. Let us do our work, and we'll find a compromise on how long this needs to be.
You know, and speaking of that work, so one of the questions that comes up quite a bit, we actually have different shows on it, is the differences between higher ed, instructional design for higher ed, or just teaching in general, like academics, versus the corporate space. There's a lot of models and things like that, right? Where people are talking a lot these days. There's a very heavy, heavy concentration on stop telling people what to do, you know, focus on the do, not the no, right? But in higher ed and in school type environments, there isn't much to do, right? The to do is to know. So, you know, how do you, like, when you're writing objectives or when you're doing that kind of work for in that academic space, you know, versus that figure out what it is they need to do on the job and teach that, okay, easy peasy, no big deal. But that other side, that academic side, how is it that you approach that?
Well, it is different. But once again, I'll say ISD is ISD. That's just one of your variables. And, you know, in my past life, I was a provost at a college. So I was the academic officer and responsible for all those things. And I know the tensions that you have at that level to make sure you make budget and do all those other things and you get the registrations and whatever. Yeah. But you have to look at what the final product is. And what you're finding in higher education is the applied programs are starting to get lots of registrations. And the old academic standbys of the sciences and other things, which are incredibly important but are different, are given a different focus. So you got to look at what the outcomes are going to be. If you're going to show someone in a practical program, which are the ones I teach in now, even at the PhD level, they're practical programs because these are people working and going to go back to work and finish their work, whether they're a physician or whatever they happen to be. And the one thing I always have in mind, which I think a lot of people don't think about, is I care about what happens when they get back in that workspace. I want the environment and learning to be exactly like that workspace. So when I do things for paramedics, I have bodies laying around on the floor. When I'm doing things for police officers, you just walked into a situation like we just saw in Texas. Now you tell me what that is. And you can't be too realistic. You have to be as close to that end work environment as you can possibly be. And people don't think about things like smell, and people don't think about lots of the aspects of what people end up working with in certain occupations. I mean, I'm not even going to go into some of it because you'll probably get a stomach ache. But the notion is, if you're not designing courses for people to use the second they leave, then you've made a mistake. You've wasted their time. It's a little different in higher ed if you're talking about general education courses. I mean, you got to look at the whole mix of academia. But in terms of applied education, if they can't use it the next minute and it isn't exactly like the work environment they're going back to, you're not doing your job.
I guess that's my point, though. So if you've got instructional designers out there who've gotten a job, because one of the things I have noticed is that universities seem to be hiring like crazy. Instructional designers. And I haven't quite figured out yet if these instructional designers are meant to train the administrative staff on how to use software that they're needing to run the university or whatever, or if this is actually instructional designers being paired up with the instructors and actually helping them do better at teaching their courses. If it's the latter, how can, like, do our processes and stuff like that and writing objectives, do they still function the same way if it's just a strictly knowledge-based course, like history, for example, right? There's no real application to it.
Doesn't matter. Because instructional design is about matching content with population with outcome expectations. And if you're in history, and the outcomes need to be, you need to be able to be cognizant and be able to talk in this space about these things. That's okay. We can write that course. If it's about, you need to be able to teach history at the academic higher education level, and here are the outcomes that we expect. You can do that. And this is, I think, is the thing where people don't appreciate what instructional design is. You can give me any population. You can give me any content area. You can give me any implementation modality. And you can give me any series of expected outcomes, and I can write you a course for that. And I've still got a bet going that I can do an entire academic course on TikTok. I mean, if you really want to do that, you can do that. And if you're a good instructional designer, you don't let all these details get in the way. You don't even think about them. You tell me what you want, I'll give you that product. In higher education, I see a lot of designers now are working, putting together programs for students so they can learn to use learning management systems, so they can learn to navigate the internal systems that the universities use for different things like registration and whatever. That's one big pocket of it, is teaching faculty and staff how to use learning management systems. There's a lot of that going on. So teach to learn, how to use stuff to teach other people to learn. Okay, my head spins, but that's what I'm hearing from people that are working in higher ed. And it's just across the board, but I'll say again, this is a boilerplate for me. Any instructional designer can take any population, any content area, any implementation modality, and any expected end product and make it work.
Mm-hmm. My own sideways entry into our space was prior to this, which I've been doing for 20 some years now. I spent a chunk of time in journalism, and the bulletin board in our office had a little one panel cartoon, and it said how journalists start their day. And the journalist had a dart in his hand and had a blindfold, and there was a wall with stickies on it. And it said, "Today I am an expert in," and they were just throwing the dartboard. Yep. This is your assignment today. You're talking about this today. And, you know, so similarly, a journalist doesn't need to be the expert in the specific content. They need to know how to ask the questions. They need to know how to, you know, find the pieces of information that other people need in order to present that to people in a story. But it's the same with us. That's kind of the magic, I really feel, of what we do, is that, you know, hey, today we're going to learn about, you know, oil refraction. Oh, I don't know anything. This is going to be cool. Oh, today we're learning about cleaning functions in hospitals. Ooh, I don't know anything about that. This is going to be cool too. So that sheer variety is, to me, one of the really coolest things of what we do.
Did we lose? I agree completely. You can hear me, but you can't see me.
Yep. Yep. Okay.
Yeah, well, that's a blessing for all those watching. since I froze up, I went back. I'll come back in. But I think we're getting closer anyway. But no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, journalism and instructional design, essentially, it's the same thing. I wake up every morning with a new challenge. And coming from that background, I think that'd be incredibly useful for you, right?
Oh, it was a perfect fit. You know, the parallels between them were fabulous. It was an easy transition for me. It was just, you know, writing into a different format. Instead of newspaper columns, suddenly I was writing e-learning courses, right? But still the same skill set applied overall. So,
yeah. No, I agree. Very good. Well, you unfroze and I'm out. So this is good.
I didn't even know you were, Chris was frozen, but
No, Chris wasn't. You were frozen to me. Yeah. So maybe not to everybody else, but it's just.
We do have a couple of links that I've thrown in to a couple of your books from ATD. The most recent one being the Introduction to Instructional Systems Design. So if folks are interested in more of that stuff, we've got a couple of links in the chat there that folks can check out. Chuck, thanks so much for joining us today. This has been a very, very cool conversation.
Yeah. And, well, we really it's been my pleasure and honor. And I hope you ask me back. I love this.
Yeah, we certainly will. We're always looking for more. That's for sure. We are an industry of passion, and we're passionate about our industry. So
that's very a great cool. way to put it. And thank you so much. The books, the links, everything dropped in there, folks. You can just do a Google search for Chuck Hodel, and you'll probably find him that way too. And reach out and stay connected. And don't forget to join us in our LinkedIn group for after live stream chats and conversations and whatnot. I'll drop that link in there.
And also, folks, don't forget, instructional designers in offices drinking coffee. We get to be idiotic here because of the sponsorship of Domino Learning Systems, makers of Domino One. I threw a link into the chat there if you're interested in learning more about what we do when we're not talking in little boxes on the screen here, what Brett and I get to do and support. So thanks so much, everybody, for joining us this week. And dance on out of here.
Make it a great day, everybody.